reason why, this is the very reason why you have this law against the denial of the Holocaust. Because they know that in France we tend to deny things. The only thing that we cannot deny in France is the Holocaust. Why? Because France was guilty. Even if the General de Gaulle, the French, who was the French president in the 60s, even if, because he was an excellent negotiator, even if he was able to pass France as a country that had won the war, we all know that France lost the war and France took part in the genocide of the Jews.
Well, Massoud, now many Muslims are saying, and you were talking about this a bit ago, saying the future for Muslims in France and in the West in general, they see it as more repression and a greater crackdown and attack on their Islamic identity. What do you think? I want to look at France, and then I want to look at other countries such as the UK or the US in general. Do you see that it's a level of deterioration in dealing with relations with Muslims in these countries or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Islamophobia is this century's racism and is very ripe. And, you know, bigots and the extreme right and those who want to sort of have a cultural wars and the sort of puritanism of white skin and so forth are involved in Islamophobia because this is acceptable form of racism. It leads to other forms of racism eventually. And the fact of the matter is that now in most of the world, people don't deny that there is Islamophobia, but what they do as classical racism, they blame the victims of you know, they blame the Muslims. You know, Macron and likes of him. You know, I don't think they deny it, but what they say is actually is extremism within the Muslims, which is the cause of Islamophobia, and so we should shut down all the Islamic sort of centers and so forth as a means of combating Islamophobia. And I think that's the real key thing. The fact of the matter is that there is an attempt to socially engineer a new form of Islam, an Islam which is subservient to oppression and will not challenge, will not speak the truth to the power, and become subservient colonial subject. And that's what they want to do to us Muslims right across the West.
Well, what's key, Mostafa? What is key in your perspective to changing what seems to be coming more and more a growing reality and this attack on Muslims and more Muslims actually, in certain cases, losing their Islamic identity to fit in, to get a job, to progress or succeed in these various countries? What's key to changing this around?
Well, I think that the most important for the Muslims living in France is to get financial power, because it's very sad to speak like this, but it seems that the society we live in only understand the language of money. When you have money, they will keep quiet. So once the Muslim community in France will have a purchasing power, will have an economic power, I think things are going to be easier for us. Our votes are going to count. So this is what we have to do. Keep on working hard in terms of education, getting ourselves educated at university. Even university, you know, I work at university, but I know I'm in good university. I'm lucky for that, but I know in some universities they do not like people like me, like myself. Why? Because my background is Muslim, because I did a PhD involving the Muslim community and all these things. So okay, we are targeted.
All right, let me give 30 seconds to Massoud. Same question. Your take, Massoud. What's key?
Well, I you know, the money and the power, it's useless if there is no self-confidence and confidence in ourselves and in our deen and our belief. We need to be a confident community to withhold this sort of abuses. This is, you know, one side of the abuse. Then on the other side, we've got all these home office or house Muslims who are, you know, trying to implement the same thing on behalf of their masters. We need to be confident to withstand these attacks on us and move forward. And I'm convinced that if we do that and if we stand up for justice for all of us, Muslim and non-Muslim in our society, we could actually come together and create a better life for all of us. But we need to fight back.
All right. Thanks so much, both of you, for being with us on this debate. The head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajere, out of London, and activist and commentator Mustafa Chaira, out of Paris. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life. Here on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. In the previous program, dear brothers and sisters, we talked about arrogance and how we considered it to be the first sin, and how arrogance threatens scholars of the deen and also scholars in other fields, and even among us common laymen, common students, workers, colleagues, and so on and so forth. And we also gave examples of different societies which had arrogance because of the color of the skin, how they treated people differently, all the way from lynching the blacks to police brutality to slavery. And the danger of arrogance is that one would leave worship and enter into a state of ignorance. Ignorance is when one does not see reality. He considers his imagination to be true, not reality. One reality, for example, is that every existence in every level is less than the existence of the seal of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. That is one reality. Whoever considers his existence to be dependent and his existence to be from someone else is present and everlasting. But whoever thinks that his existence is in his own hands must see that he or she would die even if he does not want to. And he would continue to live even if he does not want to. One would not die until Allah allows him to die, even if he tries to kill himself. Not only is his life in someone else's hands, but his death is in someone else's hands as well. You are sheer poverty, and Allah is the one without any need. The verse of the Noble Quran says, O mankind, Ya ayyuhan nas, antumul fuqara ila Allah. You are the ones in need in front of Allah. And Allah, wallahu huwa al-ghaniyul hamid. And Allah is the one without need, the praiseworthy. So we are all dependent. We are not independent at all, not even for a second. We are all dependent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So why should we feel arrogance? Our existence in a vertical line is lower than the seal of the prophets, which is on the top of the line, and all the other prophets who are also on top of the line, the awliya Allah and so on and so forth, until it reaches us. We are on the top of the line when it comes to other animals and plants and stones. But sometimes, because of our sins and our animalistic lust, we also fall lower than animals. Not only is this life of ours in someone else's hands, but our death is also in someone else's hand as well. There was an article that a man in New York took a loan for millions of dollars in order to build a skyscraper. The skyscraper was left halfway done, and he did not have the ability to complete it. Nobody else would give him a loan. Now he has a huge debt on his shoulders that is increasing daily due to interest, and his skyscraper remained halfway done. And nobody wanted to rent it. He decided to commit suicide by jumping off the top floor. He then thought, maybe I will not die by jumping, so it is better to drink poison and then jump off the building.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oasis. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
He thought that he would definitely die from one of the two reasons. He drank the poison and jumped head first off the building. On his way down, he crashed into a pole on the building and threw up the poison. On his way down, he crashed into a pole on the building and threw up the poison, so he did not die in either way that he had thought he would. When Allah does not want something, there is nothing that one can do. We must understand that life is not in our hands, not the start of life and not the continuance of life. Likewise, death is also not in our hands. It doesn't matter if you are the CEO of a billion-dollar corporation. Why do we feel this arrogance? You have all these CEOs who are billionaires and have billion-dollar corporations. Are they feeling arrogance? Sooner or later, they will leave everything behind and die, and nothing of that will go with them into the grave. So why this arrogance? Why treat other people differently? We have been created, raised, and remain living without choice. There are three choices you can make during your life. But there are some choices that you cannot make. It is in the hands of Allah. And that is that you have been created, born, raised, and remain living with choice, without choice. And you would die without choice. Everyone is dependent on Allah. And Allah is the only independent existence. Man must have the ability to do whatever he wants to do. Is he able to bring about this ability in himself? Do not say, I am doing this. Do you have the ability to do what you want? Your existence is not in your hands for you to be able to say that qualities such as ability are in your hands. We say, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. There is no power and strength except with Allah or in Allah. A scholar of the deen is also in need of Allah regarding his knowledge. One should not consider himself independent. No matter how much knowledge we have, being dependent is part of man's nature. One must not forget that he is dependent as long as he is alive. The place of knowledge is in one's memory. Allah decides how long knowledge remains in one's memory. 50 years ago, there was a scholar who taught a book. One day, when he woke up, he forgot how to recite the first chapter of the Quran. He was in a state of forgetfulness. When he entered the classroom, it was as if he had never read the book before, and as if he had never attended school before. He even forgot how to say, in the name of Allah, Bismillah. The memory stores knowledge like a computer, and this memory is one of the proofs that one's nafs is immaterial. One of the reasons for saying that the nafs is immaterial is the mind, the memory. The memory holds all information that we have learned during our lifetime. For example, the alphabet that one learns in first grade, if one's memory is taken from him, he will even forget the alphabet. So a scholar of the deen is still in need of Allah, even in regards his knowledge. And that is a shout out to all of us. We should not be arrogant because of the things we know. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is on me.
All I need.
is all I need.
On the news line.
It seems that even when Britain is down on its knees, it receives yet another kick in the teeth to make sure it won't get up again. The acclaimed and once respected British retail industry has seen two of its super heavyweights each receive a knockout blow to go with the rest of the nation, as both have collapsed dramatically within a day of each other. After 242 years of trading on the British high street, what started off as a single store in London, well-known brand Debenhams has collapsed, putting at risk thousands of jobs and seeing 124 stores set to close for good, leaving a significant gap in the retail areas of the UK. Joining Debenhams and collapsing just a day before is the Arcadia Group, which owns the likes of Topshop, Burton, Dorothy Perkins and Evans, and will see 13,000 employees looking for work as Christmas approaches and a grim year comes to an end.
What all retailers need to understand, and some do it better than others, is that we need to have a reason to visit their stores. So I think as one of the lessons from this, although sadly for the workforce at Arcadia that might not apply so much, but for the industry, one of the lessons is that your store estate has got to be great. It's got to inspire, it's got to excite, and it's got to draw people in.
Between Debenhams and Arcadia, some 25,000 people will now join the unemployment figures that Britain is already suffering with. And alarmingly, with the majority of staff in the retail sector fairly unskilled, the prospects of a new job are far from a reality. Yet it's not just the retail sector that has suffered in Britain, with many other industries and big names collapsing in 2020, in part due to the COVID-19 virus, but also thanks to the disastrous handling of Brexit, which has seen many low-skilled workers flee the UK into richer European markets, leaving a gap in the labour market that's simply not being filled by the British. What now remains to be seen is whether the introduction of the upcoming vaccine created by Pfizer and BioNTech, which has just been approved by the British government, will come in time to save the other few remaining retail outlets that are hanging on by a thread as Brexit fast approaches, the COVID-19 pandemic peaks at its second wave, and the people and institutions of Britain are left on a knife edge as uncertainty reigns over the country. The next 36 hours will be crucial as Michel Barnier continues to work around the clock to put pressure on the British negotiating team to accept the terms and conditions being imposed by the EU. With Barnier in constant liaison with the 27 remaining EU states as to the progress of the talks, of which he holds the power of attorney on behalf of the EU. Yet in spite of multiple rounds of talks, Barnier remains far from optimistic that a deal can be done, and has warned the EU nations to face the very real prospect that Britain will leave the EU with no deal, leaving trade and commerce to continue under WTO rules, which will no doubt be far more painful for Britain than it will for the EU. Many EU nations have stated that they support Barnier and are insisting that he remain tough to the end, suggesting that under no circumstances should he compromise with the British to allow a deal to go through, unless it fully benefits the EU, with France leading the resistance and seeing backing from many other European superpowers.
Und ich wünsche Michel Barnier und gegebenenfalls auch Ursula von der Leyen viel Kraft und viel Geschick für die letzten Verhandlungsschritte. Wir brauchen aber auch kein Abkommen um jeden Preis. Das haben wir deutlich gemacht. Wir wollen eins, aber wir werden sonst auch Maßnahmen ergreifen, die notwendig sind. Auf jeden Fall liegt ein Abkommen im Interesse aller.
So clear is the obvious lack of leadership displayed by the British negotiating team and the Conservative government of Boris Johnson, who so eagerly fought for Brexit, that the people of Britain are also waking up to the reality of the impact of Brexit, such as the collapse of the British retail industry, with many in Britain now showing signs that they're worried about what the future may hold for the tiny island nation. What is guaranteed is that Britain can no longer put all the blame on the COVID-19 virus for its disastrous year, and must now finally acknowledge that without the EU powerhouse to prop it up, Britain is weak and is falling faster than a house of cards. Death to America and Israel. with the Iranian lawmakers chanting condemnation of the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. The day started with the passing of a draft bill at Iran's parliament. This was the first retaliation by Iran after the assassination of the Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The provisions that were passed, which still need to be approved before turning into law, were the backbone of the JCPOA, hard-fought in negotiations between Iran and the world powers. Some of the provisions that were passed by Iran's parliament include the enrichment of uranium up to 20% level and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to launch a plant to produce metal uranium in Esfahan. It would also revive heavy water reactor within 2 to 4 months. The number of centrifuges would also increase. This would be a clear blow to the IAEA and the world powers, since Iran has been compliant in working with the organization. But Parliament has also set a 3-month deadline for it to stop applying additional protocols of the IAEA, a draft bill that will also require the Iranian government to stop any IAEA inspections beyond additional protocol. All of this should sound familiar, since they were part of the JCPOA. But now, Iran is arguing that enough is enough. The JCPOA wasn't even fully operational, and that it had become a tool for the European signatories to apply pressure on Iran, whilst allowing the EU to remain on the fence when it came to treading between Iran and the United States.
Well, ever since the United States, at the behest of Donald Trump, left the JCPOA, and I believe that's about 2.5 years ago, there has been repeated urgings by the European powers that are still in the agreement and the other powers that are still in the agreement to wait, to beseeching Iran to wait, that they'll do something, they'll take measures to help relieve the problem of the sanctions imposed by the United States. But as far as we can see, very, very little has happened. So it comes to a point where now we have another assassination of a leading scientist, leading official. We have word from Washington that the Trump administration and Trump himself is thinking, can we have a military strike on Iran? So, you know, given these circumstances, I don't think that the Iranian government had any choice but to take further action.
When the US pulled out of the JCPOA under the executive order of Donald Trump, the EU stated that they would remain committed to the accord and continue to respect the terms and conditions of the agreement. Yet, the EU have simply used their rhetoric to sit neatly on the fence and neither respect or disregard issues such as trade, sanctions, and diplomacy with Iran. Yet, with Donald Trump still at the helm at the White House, at least until January, the EU must now start to lobby support from President-elect Joe Biden, which is something that should not be too difficult, as Biden himself has stated that he would like to re-enter the JCPOA once he takes office. Yet for Iran, the options that lie ahead are plentiful when it comes to managing how it will emerge from the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and how it plays out its diplomatic options in the future, with the expansion of its peaceful civilian nuclear program being just the first step. But what other options then could Iran also choose?
Well, for one thing, Iran could have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, inspectors leave. The inspectors, ever since the JCPOA was put into place in 2015, they have over and over and over again stated that Iran is meeting all the conditions of the JCPOA. But why would Iran continue to meet the conditions of the JCPOA when other countries are not? And when their adherence to the conditions of the JCPOA, the Iranian government's adherence to them, has not produced anything that is helpful to Iran. And in fact, the situation has gone downhill.
Does this then mean that the Israeli regime has shot itself in the foot by assassinating Fakhrizadeh? Already many nations across the globe have condemned the act, and the consequences now mean that Iran has the upper hand, should the future lead to the negotiating table, with Iran able to cite the illegal actions of the Israeli regime as a key reason to undermine the Zionist government of Netanyahu and co.
Well,
For Iran, as a force for peace in the region and the rest of the world, the time has come for it to progress into the future, having defiantly beaten the maximum pressure policy imposed by Trump, and show the world that it's a cooperative partner. Yet should the need arise, it can still continue on its very capable path without relying on any other nation in the process. As the people and officials of Iran turned out to pay their respects to the assassinated nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the evidence surrounding the murder began to come to light as more and more clues began to emerge about the circumstances that led up to the killing. Various voices have sent messages of condolences to Iran, as well as to the family and friends of Fakhrizadeh, coupled with strong words of condemnation over the assassination by the likes of the European Union, Hamas, Hezbollah, as well as countries like the United Arab Emirates, China, Jordan, and the UK. Yet again, in circumstances similar to the assassination of Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, or Arbitrary Executions has stated that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh constituted as an extrajudicial killing, suggesting foul play was at the heart of the act. It seems that further evidence has emerged that following the information revealed to Press TV, indications are pointing towards equipment being used in the attack originating from the Israeli regime's arsenal, with senior Iranian officials also stating that the technology used to commit the act was complicated and used remote devices, raising the question as to why the global arena is not calling for this crime to be investigated.
Israelis, they have the capacity and expertise in this. They have done it before. They have assassinated, with the help of the United States, some other Iranian scientists. And they have the motivation. They can gain from this assassination. So there are many reasons to say that Israelis, maybe with the help of Americans, they have done it. Whether other countries, including some of their Arab allies, are also involved in this or not, that's the question. And I think after the investigation and official conclusion, we might be hearing about this from Iranian officials. And according to that conclusion, I think we might be seeing a reaction from Iranian side.
As usual, the Israeli regime has remained eerily silent over the assassination, suggesting by the silence that they have too much to hide, which is not uncommon, as the regime have remained coy on numerous occasions in the past when it comes to the assassination of targets by the Zionist regime. Yet even if the Israelis are not responsible for pulling the trigger, the apparent use of satellite technology to activate the devices used clearly shows some notion of state-sponsored activity and likely sees the Israeli regime's criminal counterparts from the MEK also play a part in the logistics and execution of the act in Iran, something that again bears all the common denominators of a Zionist plot. Tension appears to have risen in the recent weeks following the US elections, especially in parts of West Asia, where traditional allies to the US have started to express concerns that they'll not receive preferential treatment during the next US government's term in office. The emerging evidence that shows the weaponry used in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh had the hallmarks of Israeli origin suggests that the murder was not solely aimed at stopping the Islamic Republic of Iran pursuing its legitimate and peaceful civilian nuclear program, but was really an act of extreme provocation. A recent meeting in the Saudi region of Neom between Mike Pompeo, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Mohammed bin Salman, which has been denied by some, suggests that the planned assassination of Fakhrizadeh was discussed at the meeting, putting the three states on high alert prior to the action. With all three regimes opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran, the notion of no smoke without fire has never been truer when it comes to this sensitive issue. Was it then the Israeli regime that masterminded the assassination, gaining a nod from its friends along the way? Iran's reaction has been one vowing revenge for the assassination of the esteemed nuclear scientist. Yet, revenge for Iran does not necessarily mean in a like-for-like form of self-defense. For Iran, the most powerful form of revenge could come in the form of a diplomatic card, with the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani, for one, stating that Iran is far too wise to fall into the trap set by the Zionist regime to provoke Iran into starting a conflict.
I think Iran is in a situation whereby assumes any reaction or response to this assassination inevitable. because if it doesn't respond, it will make the other side to advance further, and that will encourage them to do further assassinations or actions against Iran. But any serious response also might have a risk of, let's say, chain of actions or reaction which might end in a conflict in the region.
With diplomacy on the table, the most painful strike to the murderous Zionist regime would be showing the world that as a peace-loving nation, the pen is mightier than the sword.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. And here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus. European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. And here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scott Atlas had no prior experience in public health, but grabbed Trump's attention during his flame-throwing appearances on Fox News and joined the Trump administration as an advisor in August. Atlas proceeded to push a libertarian approach to managing the pandemic. He questioned the effectiveness of social distancing, considered widespread testing to control the virus unnecessary, all the while he derided widespread closures and questioned the utility of mask wearing as part of an overall belief in the highly questionable herd immunity approach to solving the virus. At last, coronavirus views, as you may have suspected, conveniently jived with Trump's anti-science takes on all aspects of the virus. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansel Ryder. This article is published under the heading 268,000 Americans died, and Scott Atlas shrugged. Trump's most dangerous COVID advisor quits. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Scott Atlas, President Donald Trump's favorite and most dangerous COVID-19 advisor, announced his resignation from his White House position recently, just days after his 130-day role on the coronavirus task force was set to expire, a move that was welcomed by critics who say the Stanford University radiologist's views on the deadly pandemic are inconsistent with epidemiological recommendations and harmful to the nation's public health. I worked hard with a singular focus to save lives and help Americans through this pandemic, Atlas wrote in his resignation letter. The coronavirus pandemic has killed more than 268,000 Americans, and NPR reported recently that since Atlas began his job in August, nearly 100,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the U.S. Slate summarized Atlas' tenure recently. Atlas had no prior experience in public health, but grabbed Trump's attention during his flame-throwing appearances on Fox News and joined the Trump administration as an advisor in August. Atlas proceeded to push a libertarian approach to managing the pandemic. He questioned the effectiveness of social distancing, considered widespread testing to control the virus unnecessary, all the while he derided widespread closures and questioned the utility of mask wearing as part of an overall belief in the highly questionable herd immunity approach to solving the virus. Atlas coronavirus views, as you may have suspected, conveniently jived with Trump's anti-science takes on all aspects of the virus. Progressives characterized Atlas' embrace of herd immunity as not just highly questionable, but rather as a potential massacre that would require over 200 million people to be infected, resulting in millions of deaths, as Common Dreams reported in September. In his resignation letter, Atlas insisted he always relied on the latest science and evidence, without any political consideration or influence. As time went on, like all scientists and health policy scholars, learned new information and synthesized the latest data from around the world, all in an effort to provide you with the best information to serve the greater public good, he said. Atlas claimed to have focused in particular on looking out for the working class and the poor. The U.S. has more than 13.5 million COVID-19 cases as of Tuesday, December 1st, and as Les Leopold showed in October Common Dreams essay, low-income Americans will bear the greatest burden as infections and deaths surge. He's an MRI guy. He has no expertise in any of this stuff. Dr. Ashish Jha, the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, told NPR. Despite having no background in infectious diseases, Atlas has been bringing out arguments that have been refuted week after week, month after month, since the beginning of this outbreak, Jha added. Matthew Gertz, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, illustrated one example of the clash between Atlas' anti-lockdown opinions and real-world evidence. On October 30, Atlas told Fox News, "All lockdowns do are destroy families, really kill people, and it's amazing to me that places, unfortunately, like the UK and France, have not learned their lesson." Meanwhile, data comparing the three countries' trajectories completely undermine Atlas' talking points. "He is a destructive force," a federal health official told the Daily Beast last month. "I mean, at this point, I don't know how else to explain what he is doing. It's really disruptive." Trump's outgoing advisor took a leave of absence from his position as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a conservative think tank at Stanford, to temporarily join the White House. The university has in recent weeks distanced itself from Atlas, especially after he called for an uprising against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer following the Democratic leader's implementation of new public health measures last month.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. You are listening to The Lantern, only on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of the show. Often I think about the habits I have. Like, it's a habit of mine to begin every show with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. And when we think about it, we all have these sort of habits in our lives. How does this have to do anything with anything? Well, let's listen to a short story, and you guys are going to get what exactly it is that I'm talking about. So stay with us.
Mm-hmm. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, dear friends, salam. So welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. What's the title of that? The Wise Old Man. A wealthy man requested an old scholar to wean his son away from his bad habits. The scholar took the youth for a stroll through a garden. Stopping suddenly, he asked the boy to pull out a tiny plant growing there. The youth held the plant between his thumb and forefinger and pulled it out. The old man then asked him to pull out a slightly bigger plant. The youth pulled hard and the plant came out, roots and all. "Now pull out that one," said the old man, pointing to a bush. The boy had to use all his strength to pull it out. "Now take this one out," said the old man, indicating a guava tree. The youth grasped the trunk and tried to pull it out, but it would not budge. "It's impossible," said the boy, panting with the effort. "So it's with bad habits," said the sage. "When they are young, it's easy to pull them out, but when they take hold, they can't be uprooted." The session with the old man changed the boy's life. And of course, we learn 1.2. Don't wait for bad habits to grow in you. Drop them while you have control over it, else they will get control of you.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The thing about habits is that almost anything can become a habit of ours. Like we mentioned before, good habits are something that through practice and perseverance, we can pick up as well. Good habits like replacing bad habits, you know? If we have the bad habit of cussing whenever we're startled or frustrated, we can switch it up with a dhikr. Every time something startles me, actually it's a really cool thing that my brother does. Every time something startles him, he goes, "La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah." And I think it's very good, you know. I think it really strengthens his heart and it turns the situation for the better, because it's a remembrance of Allah, and those divine words that are uttered will fill the air with positive energy instead of foul words. Or if I have a habit of fidgeting with my phone all the time, which unfortunately I do, I can replace it. I can download some books on my phone. I can download some hadith applications on my phone, a Quran and Mafatih. When I'm in intervals during my day, when I'm waiting for the studio to empty, when I'm waiting for the car to come pick me up, when I'm waiting for the bus at the bus stop, I can just open one of these applications instead of mindlessly going through Instagram and facing God knows what sort of content that could probably pollute my day and cause me to, you know, not be present during moments that count, like when I'm praying, when I'm talking to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when I'm reading a supplication. Instead, I could refer to my hadith app, or I could open my Quran app and read a few verses of the Quran while I'm waiting. And this will slowly turn into a habit, and every time that I'm free, I'm not working, I'm not recording, I feel a void. I feel a sense of loneliness, and I feel bored if I'm not reciting the Quran. Something has to turn into my habit anyway. I know that we often say that prayer should not become a habit for you. You should do it out of consciousness and awareness. As true as that may be, I am going to have a habit anyway. So why not make that habit something that will help my growth, something that will bring me closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The other thing about habits is that even if they're not bad habits, but because they've become so encrypted into our minds, our personalities, we often feel that if we don't do it, we you know, it triggers us. It triggers us a sort of anxious feeling in us. Like if I have like that for a lot of smokers, I know that much. Sure, it's also because of the nicotine withdrawal, but if they don't smoke, they feel like, I'm so restless. I'm so anxious. There's something missing, you know? Like, I have a habit of chewing gum, and if I don't chew gum, I literally feel anxious. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, however, teaches us that the greatest virtues are gained through controlling our habits, overcoming them. If I have a habit of chewing gum, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but if I fight that habit in order to gain something greater, in order to tame my lower self, to tame my nafs, to have my nafs within my control, then a simple act of stopping myself from chewing gum can be a process of growth. So I'm not necessarily trying to say that all habits are bad, but because they become such a staple part of who we are, fighting it can help us better ourselves than what we already are. And that's the whole point at the end of the day of recognizing our habits and trying to change them for the better. Just become better people. I mean, it's not this sadistic sort of ideology that, oh, I always have to be on guard and fight with myself all the time. That's not necessarily the case. But because our nafs, our lower self, is so treacherous, it's so deceiving, and it's like a fish. It's constantly trying to slip out of our hands and dive into the depth of the waters of temptation and desire. To be able to control it, to be able to put boundaries and limits for it, will help us in the long term. Like fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. There's nothing wrong with eating and drinking. As a matter of fact, it's our biological need. If we stop eating and drinking, we'll die. Are we to say, well, God, you created me this way. You created me with the need to eat and drink. Why are you telling me to stop? He's telling us to refrain from eating and drinking for a specific period of time so that we fight that habit in order for us to grow. If I can tell myself, no, Zainab, you are not eating lunch today because it's the 2nd of Ramadan. I break that habit a while from that. If I consciously do that, a while from that, I'll be able to tell myself, no, Zainab, you're not listening to that music. No, Zainab, you're not engaging in that conversation. No, Zainab, you're not going to look at that content. No, Zainab, you're not going to tell that lie because it's haram and it will take me further from Allah. So basically, that's how the process works. Inshallah ta'ala, I hope and pray that we are able to fight our bad habits first and foremost, and that we are able to develop good habits that will help us become better people. With the grace and blessings of the Ahlul Bayt. Thank you for being with us on The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.